Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
To the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting on air. My name's Rebecca and I'm an alcoholic and chairperson for today's meeting. We open AA meetings with the Serenity Prayer and I invite you to join me with that.
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference.
And now I'll read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organisation or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. You're listening to Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM and this is the AA meeting on air. Today we've got with us Wednesday night Steps and Traditions so they normally open with a brief reading. I'm going to pass over to Cass to do that for us.
Thanks, Rebecca. Hi, I'm Cass. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Cass.
And I'm just going to read a paragraph from page 24 and a paragraph from page 25 of the big book. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defence against the first drink. There is a solution. Almost none of us liked the self-searching, the levelling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings which the process requires for its successful consummation. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. And I'll pass over to Anne.
Thanks, Cass. I'm Anne. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Anne.
And I was just listening to the reading when we're forced to face the hopelessness and futility of our lives, and nothing else would have done it for me. That's exactly the point I reached, forced to face that I can't go on with the way I was living, but I don't know how to change it. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous at 22, and I came in via a detox centre because I had turned up for work one morning too drunk to work, and that was my natural pattern of life. I drank in the morning, I drank while I was driving, I drank all day, every day. Whenever, I was awake, that was what I was thinking about or wanting to do. I had very little ability to manage my life because it evolved around drinking, around blacking out, around dealing with life in my head, with my resentments, with my guilt and with my shame about the things I had done as a practicing drinker on a daily basis. And when I came in to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was not that I thought this was my answer. It was that I didn't know what my problem really was, and this was offered as something to look at. But what I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous was that I could leave the meeting and not pick up a drink again. And that was something I'd not ever considered in my life. And when eventually I was ready to surrender the alcohol because I needed to change Alcoholics Anonymous was there to help me, and I began attending meetings, and I began reaching out to the other women in the fellowship and asking for advice one day at a time. I learnt how to put the booze down. I went to meetings. I got a home group. I got a sponsor. I began reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which gave me things to identify with. Yes, I'm like this. Yes, I do that. And then that pathway of actually you can change if you want to try these few simple things. And I began the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It has been a lifelong journey, and remaining in AA, remaining amongst my type of people, and still going to meetings. And why do I still go to meetings? Because I hear that message that I need to hear. I'm reminded why I still don't drink, that if I pick up a drink, I will get all of those old ways back again. And I do believe that. I believe I am a genetic type alcoholic, i.e. I believe I was born with it. And when I picked up that first drink, I was already away. I got drunk the first time. I blacked out in my early teens, and my behaviour didn't improve at all the time I was drinking. AA has shown me a way to live life, what we term on life's terms, i.e. I can cope with what comes along and I do not need to pick up a drink. I have coping mechanisms and skills that enable me to meet life as, in the eyes, looking it square in the eyes. I have learnt as an alcoholic that I require a higher power, if that makes sense. I surrender my life and my will over to the care of my higher power, whom I choose to call God, and that's been another journey for me. AA has given me a life beyond my wildest dreams, as Cass talked about in that reading. What does that mean? It means for me a full life. I go to work each day. I have had a long-term relationship. I have been a mother and raised children. I have a cat. I participate in groups, and I can do all of those things without picking up a drink. I can turn up and be reliable, and I am someone who I would call rebellious and defiant, did not like authority, but I can live life without having to tell people what I think, you know, without telling you where to go, and be responsible. And for that, I'm, you know, eternally grateful. So thank you. I'm happy to leave it there.
Thanks, Anne. Now I'm going to pass over to Renee, if you'd like to share.
Hi, I'm Renee, alcoholic.
Hi, Renee.
And it's an interesting experience doing this on the radio. I've done it before, but it feels pressure. But anyway, you know, that's out the way now. You all know I feel pressure. But I'm an alcoholic, and I'm very grateful to be sober. I remember my first drink. I remember how I was with my family, and I was like 11 or something, and I was at a restaurant, well-known one where it's not there anymore, but it used to be. I remember how it made me feel, and my instinct was, oh my God, that's why they do it, you know. That's why they do it, you know. I just felt it hit my throat, my stomach, and, you know, and I got a real sense of ease and comfort. And I don't know that everybody feels like that, but, it made me feel like that. And that was the feeling that I sought through my whole drinking career. And I didn't realise that, you know, there must have been something very wrong with my emotional state or whatever for something like that to just make me feel at peace or at ease. I remember, I don't think I got given another drink. It was like half a glass of cheap bubbly in a cheap restaurant where I live with my family. And, you know, I was with my parents, and one was an alcoholic and the other one you know, she could be in an Al-Anon, but and one of my sisters is part of this fellowship as well, or has been in the past. And so, you know, and there's a long history of it in my family that often people prefer not to acknowledge. But, you know, the legacy of that still continues in my family. But, you know, I think as far as I'm aware, I was the first one to get sober. And I was looking at Ancestry.com the other day, and there was somebody that died in a sane asylum in Auckland. And I'm thinking, man, there must have been some good, you know, nobody ever really told me that. Do you know what I mean? Like, so, and you think that there's really just something really wrong with you. Well, that's what I thought. And, you know, so I started drinking then, and from then on, every opportunity I got, I drank. You know, whether that be before exams, jumping out the window, filling up my Tupperware container with alcohol to go to parties because I wasn't allowed out because I was too random, you know, and until eventually I had a child quite young. And that kind of scuppered me for a little bit, not long. I had two children before I was 20. And you know, every time I went somewhere, if I could have a drink, I would. But I didn't have the means or the funds or the time or even the really understanding it. But when I could get drunk, I would get drunk. And so eventually I ended up on my own with those kids, and, you know, the thing was off, you know, like I was like a rabbit out of a, you know, well, greyhound out of a, you know, boom, gone. I was drinking, doing lots of other things and, you know, dragging my kids around with me. And because I thought that was life. I don't know why I thought that was life. I thought that was freedom, you know. And, you know, so by the time I was 25, I was in my first AA meeting. And that wasn't because I wanted, well, I really, somebody told me I was an alcoholic and I thought, you're just trying to control me. But at that time I was in some trouble, so I went to AA and looked at the steps on the wall and thought, nah, how, you know, it just made no sense to me. But I did ring the AA line at that time, and what the lady said to me, she said, you know, you've got a disease. She said, it's not your fault that, you know, you have this disease, you didn't ask for it, it's not something that you aspired to, as, you know, like when you were five or whatever. And, you know, it's that first string that does the damage, you know. And those things are, like, that had never occurred to me. Jeez, I thought it was like when I blacked out or that drug I took, when I took that drink, you know, like, never occurred to me. So I didn't stay sober at that time. I went on for another 7 years, I think, 8 years maybe, of misery and depression and suicidal thinking and, you know, getting out, trying to convince myself not to drink, then not being able to do that and drinking and driving, you know, falling asleep on the couch when my kids are at school, not waking up to pick them up, you know, all these things. And that's just a very mild thing of what things I did. But all these things have an emotional toll on me, and spiritual, emotional, physical, you know, like at the end of my drinking, I was a 24-hour day, 7-day week drunk. I could not stop drinking. And I wasn't even really getting drunk. It was like I was just wake up, go to sleep, wake up, go to sleep. Hold my nose, throw alcohol down my throat, throw it up. I could feel my liver, my bodily functions were changing colour, and I thought that was a life. And so I can't really tell you what happened to me other than I, one day, I think it was a Sunday, I just thought, oh my God, I'm going to die soon. And I thought I was going to die. I mean, honestly, I think my body was failing, and I didn't want to die an active alcoholic anyway. And I didn't want to get found out, let's say that. And so I just realised that I had to change. And so, you know, I came to AA and I haven't had a drink since. And it's been a journey. Like, you know, I had to surrender. I have had to come to believe that a power greater than me can restore me, not just on alcohol, because alcohol is just the tip of the iceberg for me. It was everything else beyond that, you know. That covered up so much, that first alcohol. So, you know, and then I've had to, you know, hand my will and my life over, and that means for me surrender on everything. Everything that I can't control, which is most things, people, places, things, my resentments, my, you know, my emotions, my everything. So I you know, I had to do the steps. I had a sponsor, and I have to continue to do those steps. You know, I've had to look at my character defects, identify them. I've had to, and they're still there. You know, they've not gone. They might show up in different areas, and they may not be as bad, but, you know, at least I've got a way of dealing with them, and I, you know, I've had to make amends. I've had to look at my part in things, and, you know, every day I have to get up and I have to put one foot in front of the other, and I have to go, well, what's in store today? And often, you know, what I think should be is often not what is. I still live in a bit of a fantasy world, I suppose, but I have a program for living in, which is the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a God of my understanding. I can keep putting one foot in front of the other, and I'm an example of the big book, I feel, and I take that into my family. And, you know, there's lots of things in my life at the moment in my family that I'm very powerless over, and I can't do anything about it. But I can be, you know, it's really difficult to see sometimes. You know, you get upset and you make it about you, but really, what's going on for the other person? Why are they behaving like that? You know, they are damaged too. You know, most of us are. And what I've just sort of realised this week, well, I mean, I've probably realised it before, but something's been happening, and it's like, you know, this person says, you know, very, very hurt person, and some of which I have caused, and I've made amends over the year, and you think, God, am I ever going to be out of this? When's enough, you know? Like, and, but I just realised that, that person's very hurt, very hurt. They're also very unwell. And also their disdain and their negative, horrible feelings toward me is damaging them, you know? So I've got to try and get a, you know, that's sad for them. Do you know what I mean? Like, and so you've got to feel compassion and just keep trying to be, you know, an example. Or I can't, that's maybe arrogant. I just have to keep trying to work the program, stay sober, and you know, like, regardless of what happens anywhere, if I don't stay sober, you know, I got to get step one going. Yeah, and if I have a drink, then I've got no hope. But today, I'm so lucky because I don't have a desire to drink. That has been lifted from me. I don't wake up in the morning and go, far out, I've got to, you know, I'm going to drink today. No, I won't drink today. Yeah, you know, that stupid thing that goes on in my head, and then I drink, you know. It doesn't even happen to me anymore, and that is a miracle given to me by God, I believe. So anyway, thank you.
Thanks, Renee. You're listening to the AA meeting on air on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. There's lots of ways to get in touch with AA in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Like Renee mentioned, we have a free call number that's available 24/7. So people from the fellowship will answer that phone at any time of the day or night if you call 0800 229 6757. And that's a great way to get help when you need it. Now I'm going to ask Daniel to share.
Hi, my name's Daniel and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Daniel.
And I'm the token male in this outfit today. Anyway, my story is that I drank for 30 years and 10 of them were social fun drinking and 10 of them were difficult drinking times, and 10 of them were a living hell that I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. And I was a child of the 60s, and so London was a fun place to be brought up in and live in at the time, and I tried to partake in most of the goodies that were around at that time, but the principal goodie was alcohol. And I had a whale of a time growing up, and went through all the various phases of what went on in London at the time, from the swinging 60s to Irish traditional music and all that kind of stuff. But nothing was ever too far away from a drink. And shortly after I got sort of through the academic bit of my life, I got married and probably far too young, actually, now that I reflect upon it. And I got posted out to live in Dubai in 1974, which was a boozer's paradise, because you got a license to drink 500 dirhams worth of booze every month, and a bottle of gin cost 2 dirhams, so you never ran out. And and it was we worked hard and we played hard, and I remember the next door neighbour to me was a man who was about 45 and he looked about 65, and his day consisted of waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning with the sweats and the shakes from the previous day's drinking. And he was the first one in the office at 6 in the morning, and he needed to get in there at 6 in the morning to open the drawer on the right-hand side of his desk to get the gin bottle out, to get some gin down him to stop the shakes and the sweats. And before long, he was off up around town looking for replenishments. He was always the first one up at our contractors' club at lunchtime. Everybody else had sandwiches and a soft drink. He was straight into the gin-lined sodas. And he was the first one back at 4 o'clock in the afternoon when work was finished. And we had a beautiful big open window that looked out onto the Gulf. It was absolutely gorgeous. And we used to take the Mickey out of him because he was well into the gin lime sodas by the time 5:30, 5:45 was around. And we used to tell him he needed to slow down, because he'll miss the green flash when the sun goes down, because we persuaded him that there was this green flash before the sun went down. He never saw the green flash. He always passed out first, and then he was carted down to his car where his ever-loving wife had been waiting for him, and that was the end of him until 4 o'clock the next morning. And I remember saying to myself, shit, I hope that never happens to me. Can I have another Amstel, please, barman? And if I roll the camera forward 20 years, pretty much that was where I ended up. But of course, the wife had long gone by then. And so I carried on regardless. The 10 years of difficulty were when I'd kind of started, I'd actually, interestingly enough, yeah, I had 10 years of difficulty where I couldn't be relied upon. Drink driving was just a matter of the norm. You know, and quite often living in London, you were lucky if you were able to park your car within a mile of where you lived. And I used to spend many, many a Saturday morning wandering around Hammersmith looking for where the hell I'd left my car the night before. That was not unusual. And I didn't think there was anything particularly wrong with it. But that all came to a grinding halt when I was stopped coming back from along the M3 motorway, and I was stopped by the cops because I'd lost the wheel and there were sparks flying out of the car, and they didn't think that was very clever. And so they stopped me and they breathalyzed me, and I was 4.5 times over the limit, and that was a lot higher than it is now. And I was put up by the beak, and I was told that I was an alcoholic, and I said I wasn't. And she said, well, we think you are, so you're going to do a month in Pentonville. And that's what happened. And when I got into Pentonville, I got put into this cell with this young guy, about 22. And he said, what, you cock, what are you doing here? And I said, oh, I'm in here drink driving. And he said, yeah, same as me. How many times have you been done? I've been done 3 times, he said. How many times have you been done? Once, and you're in here, you're unlucky. And that was all I wanted to hear. I wanted to hear that I was unlucky, because I often say it was not the alcohol that nearly killed me. It was the denial. Now, you would have thought that that would have been enough for anybody to have said, I can't do this anymore. But I had another 10 years in me. And it was then I then moved from daily drinking and then having to drink in the mornings to stop the shakes and the sweats, like that bloke from 20 years before. And I also I was going on benders. I was doing a lot of international travel with the firm, the outfit I worked for. And I was found myself going on 3 and 4 day benders on a regular basis. And going on a 4 day bender in Lagos, Nigeria is not a very safe thing to do. And eventually I got grounded, and I didn't lose my job, but I got grounded. And things did not get better. They got worse over any period of time. And eventually I found myself having to attend detox centres because I couldn't actually detox myself because it was too excruciating. And anyway, I went into several of those for 3 or 4 days at a time. And then eventually I was taken to see this doctor, and she was a fund holder for Stockport Area Health Authority. And she said to me, I think you ought to go into treatment. And if she'd said to me, Daniel, I think you should go to the moon, I would have asked her when the first rocket was, because I had given up. I had no answer. And in fact, what had happened immediately before that, I had woken up coming out of one of these benders, and I'd looked at my watch and it was 2 o'clock, and I didn't know whether it was 2 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, that in itself was not unusual. But what was unusual was that at that precise moment, I realised for the first time that I couldn't live with alcohol, or I couldn't live without it either. And so that gave me a clear choice. I either had to find a way of getting sober, or I had to, I would have committed suicide because I couldn't carry on doing what I was doing. And so I was taken to see this doctor. She sent me to a treatment centre, which happened to be a treatment centre that worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was introduced to those steps in that place. And I saw miracles and I saw catastrophes in there. I saw miracles of people that I thought would never get sober or clean, and they did. And I saw people who I thought would, and they didn't. And so, and you know, there were all sorts of different people in there. There was one man who was in a wheelchair, and he had lost the use of his legs through alcoholic diabetes. He'd had a burst esophagus. We talk in AA about the need to have rigorous honesty with yourself. He just couldn't get honest with himself, the poor man. And he was disruptive, and they put him in a halfway house. And he was dead within a month, you know. And so I've seen the consequences, the serious consequences of alcoholism right up front in my face. And I resolved that I didn't believe the 12 steps that they were talking about. I certainly didn't believe in any kind of God, which I still don't. But I certainly got into the 12 steps. I thought, if this is working for others, it can work for me. I started to do that. And I remember very, very clearly waking up one morning, bolt upright in the bed at 6 o'clock. And then I suddenly realised that I hadn't thought about a drink the day before, and that hadn't happened for 30 years. And I thought to myself, I don't believe in this stuff, but it seems to be working. And I thought, if I can not think about a drink for one day, I might be able to think about a drink for more, not think about a drink for more than one day. And gradually, over a period of time, that is what began to happen. And I began I got out of that place, and I went to AA meetings for 7, 8, 9 meetings a week at the time. I don't do that now, but it was a great gift to me to be able to identify with people who had the same problem that I had, and were able to come to terms with it and live normal lives. And I did that, and I have been able to live a normal life. And what AA promises, it promises one thing only. It promises the ability to be able to live one day at a time without the need to drink alcohol. That need to drink alcohol has been taken away from me, and I've had some times it's sort of temptations have come, but I've always used the tools that are at my disposal to deal with it, and I've been able to do that. And and I've got, you know, lots of stuff has happened to me since then. I've got a 20-year-old son and I've got a 16-year-old daughter, and they have never seen me drinking. Alcohol does not come into the conversation for me. But that's okay. And they kind of know that I go off to these odd meetings once or twice a week, but that's it. That's all there is. I'm very grateful for the gift that I've been given. And it's, we often call it in AA, we call it the gift of desperation. And that was what I was given. I was given the gift of desperation. And I could not have done this without having had that gift of desperation. Lots of people, and I wonder at their ability to do this, seem to be able to realise that they've lost control much earlier on in the process than me. And I don't know how they do it, but I'm glad they do, because often they are spared that last 10 years of absolute hell that I went through, and they don't need to go through it because they've realised that the game's up and they've decided that they need to do something about it. So that's all I'm sharing about. Thank you.
Thanks, Daniel. You're listening to the AA meeting on air on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. I guess, like Daniel talked about, being directed toward recovery by a doctor, one of the ways that we can help the alcoholic who's still suffering is by providing good information about AA to professionals in the medical or corrections or any number of other disciplines. We're planning in the planning stages of organising an AA national survey for New Zealand. And if you're interested in learning more about this or getting involved, you can contact your delegate or people at the group or national level and find out more. It's a great way to contribute to be able to keep people who are in a place to help alcoholics who need an intervention to get into recovery. I'm going to ask Cass to share now.
Thanks, Rebecca. Hi, I'm Cass. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Cass.
It is quite nerve-wracking sharing on radio. Gosh, so where to start? Experience, strength and hope. So, yeah, I'm at the end of this year, I will be 12 years sober, which is something that I never, ever thought would happen. My drinking really became a problem after I had children. Although in hindsight, I realised that I always had a problem with alcohol and also a problem with fear and anxiety, which I didn't even know they were things, but I had them. And you know, I'd always often drink too much when I went out and make a bit of a fool of myself, or a real fool of myself. But I didn't really start to depend on alcohol to change the way I felt, which I, again, didn't even know that I was doing that until after I had children. And it was when they were babies, for some reason, I don't know, drinking was kind of a thing amongst new mums. It was a way of, you know, releasing a bit of pressure. You know, you'd get together at the end of the week and have a few drinks. And my husband also was a relatively heavy drinker. And so when I was at home with the children after they had been born and they were toddlers and well, babies and toddlers, having a drink at the end of the day became a relief, and it became a way of having something that I could do for me that wasn't, yeah, that I guess wasn't sort of, didn't feel like work. It felt like something I could do. It was a release from all the pressure. And my husband would come home from work and bring home wine, and so we'd, that became a bit of a pattern. And it started to happen daily, or most days. So it was unusual if we weren't drinking wine at the end of the day. And then after a while it turned into two bottles. And then my husband started to get a little bit concerned that it was becoming a crutch for us. And so he decided he was going to stop drinking. So he just stopped. He just stopped. He was like, right, that's it. I think this is a problem. And, you know, we'd talk a lot about whether or not we had a problem. And every so often we'd say, but we're not alcoholics. We're not that bad. Because that was just the ultimate. That was like, oh, God, imagine that. And, so he just thought it was becoming a problem. He was concerned about my drinking, and he decided he was going to stop. And I remember, I remember one August we decided we weren't going to drink, and we had this school quiz fundraiser that was, I guess, maybe the third week in August. So, you know, it had been a tough few weeks of not drinking. And he was not drinking, and I could not get through that quiz night without drinking. And we had this huge argument, and I said, look, it's fine, I, you know. But I just, everybody in our team was drinking, everybody else was drinking, normally, mind, and I just could not do it. I could not get through a month without drinking. That's just one of my memories. But, yeah, so once he actually stopped drinking, that's when it really got quite bad for me, because, of course, it made my drinking look much more obvious, and that's when I started drinking in secret. And I would also, I'd leave work early, I'd run to the supermarket to get wine, then I'd get to school to pick up the kids, and then we'd go home, and then I'd put them in front of TV. So this is, you know, shortly after 3 o'clock, and I would start drinking wine out of a cup that had, it had a kind of orange colour on the inside of it, so I thought that disguised it, and everyone thought I was drinking coffee. And I would just sit and drink wine and go on the computer while the kids sat in front of TV. And then, of course, my husband would inevitably call later in the day when he was close to coming home, and he would be absolutely listening for any signs of slurring in my voice. So it was quite hard work drinking and trying to pretend that I wasn't. And then I'd sort of casually have got another bottle of wine, which I'd pretend that I'd start drinking once he got home. So anyway, long story short, you know, I was getting to the stage where I was drinking every day. It was affecting everything in my life. It was all I could think about. And I went to the doctor. I talked to the doctor about it, and I remember the doctor did this thing where he said, he asked me these questions, and he came to the conclusion that I wasn't an alcoholic because I felt guilt. This is my memory. To be fair, my doctor probably knew that I was, because why would I be going to the doctor being worried about my drinking if I wasn't an alcoholic? But my take out of that meeting with my doctor was that he thought I was fine, so because I only felt a bit of guilt, and that was the marker on the thing. I just, you know, the things that I would tell myself I wasn't an alcoholic. You know, I went to CADS, I went to CareNZ, you know, I went to my doctor. I tried drugs to stop drinking. I tried antabuse. I tried this thing called naltrexone, which this is a while ago now. I don't know what they do now, but at the time the doctor said, this will be great because you don't feel like drinking as much. But that didn't work because it was supposed to take away the impact of the drink or that nice feeling that I had, so therefore I wouldn't feel like drinking more. But of course, because I wasn't getting the feeling that I wanted, I just drank more to try and get the feeling. So I was on medication, I was drinking. Anyway, you know, for me it was terrifying finally coming to the realisation that I had a problem, because I wanted to be so normal. I so badly just wanted to be normal. And it just, to me, admitting that I had a problem with alcohol was just, I felt so much shame. I felt so shameful. But, you know, I came to AA and I'm, you know, like Daniel was saying, I actually, it took me a long time to stop drinking. Even after I came to AA, it took me a couple of years. And I don't know why. I don't know why, but I'm very, very grateful that I didn't stop coming. I kept coming back to meetings and I kept hearing the message, you know, and it slowly dawned on me. Other people might get this much faster, but it slowly dawned on me that as long as I kept on drinking, my life was never, ever going to get better. It was only going to get worse. And I don't know what happened, but, you know, and I had periods of sobriety. I had periods of short periods of sobriety. Well, I wouldn't even call it sobriety because it was just I was white knuckling it. But I was miserable. I was miserable. It was like every day was just an effort not to drink, and I was not happy. So I don't know what happened. I went out again one night when I wasn't meant to go out, and I came and I made a fool of myself, and I came home, and I remember waking up the next morning, and it suddenly dawned on me that as long as I kept drinking, I was going to keep having these problems. You know, all the problems that I had were caused by alcohol. As much as I desperately didn't want that to be the case, it was the case. And, you know, they talk about it being a disease of denial. You know, it's the disease that tells you you don't have a disease. Well, as soon as I let go and accepted that I had a disease, it was like, what was I so worried about? Like, all of a sudden, I could get on with living again. So as soon as I made that decision, I just surrendered. I just made the decision to get on with it. And I can honestly say that if anybody is struggling, you know, it's not the end of the world. It's the beginning of a whole new one. It's my life is so much better now. And as soon as I just put down that drink and started working those steps, I realized all these things about myself that had been driving me and driving my behavior and not and creating problems, not just for me, but for people around me, you know. And it didn't matter whether it was my family, my workmates, my friends. I was a really difficult person. And it all stemmed from this disease of self. So, you know, that's my advice, is don't give up, keep going. Do I need to think about finishing? Okay, I just say keep coming back. Don't be afraid of this thing. It's a miracle. And, yeah, just work those steps, get a sponsor, get a home group, embrace it because, you know, as diseases go, there is a solution and, you know, things could be a hell of a lot worse. So my life is 100% better than it ever was before. So, yeah, thank you.
Thanks so much, Cass, and thanks everyone from the Wednesday Steps and Traditions meeting in Wellington. You've been listening to the AA meeting on air on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. Just another little plug about the ways to get in touch with AA in New Zealand. Aotearoa New Zealand, we've got that free call 0800 number I was talking about before. You can also email on help@aa.org.nz if you're not feeling kind of up to talking to a real person. I think, you know, we've all felt like that at times. So, you know, if you're listening to this and you think you're having trouble with your drinking, you may be interested in investigating AA, hop on the website and have a little look around. Likewise, if you think someone you know might be having a problem. Now, I guess we'll close with the Serenity Prayer.
Thanks, Rebecca.
God.
Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference.
Thanks, everyone. Once again, that's the Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM and the AA meeting on air. We're on once a month. We'll see you next time.
That program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks, New Zealand On Air, for funding accessmedia.nz.